one project that I want to make with this podcast is to read through little books that are interesting to me at the time. And one of these right now is called In Tune with the World, A Theory of Festivity. And it's by Josef Pieper, who was a major German Thomist. He was writing this in 1963 in German, published by Harcourt, Brace, and World in 1965 in English. It looks like I'm reading from a later edition of that, published 1973. Chapter 1. Well, first, the epigraph. Ubi caritas gaudet, ibi est festivitatis. Festivitas. From John Chrysostom. Where love rejoices, there is festivity. Note to the reader. The German word fest embraces the meanings of English feast, festival, festivity, fete, holiday, and kindred notions. The German feier, from Latin feria, also has a broad spectrum of meanings. Celebration, solemnization, leisure, time after work, holiday, etc. In this translation, no attempt has been made to establish a consistent terminology based on these words. They are rendered differently in different contexts. It may, however, be helpful to the reader to realize that either fest or feier, or its derivatives, underlies the English variants. Chapter 1. Certain things can be adequately discussed only if at the same time we speak of the whole of the world and of life. If we are not ready to do that, we give up all claim to saying anything significant. Death and love are such subjects. Festivity, too, must be included in that category. This becomes apparent as soon as we try to get beyond mere description of the facts. Let us start with what lies nearest to hand. If, for example, we consider the distinction between the festive and the workaday, we soon realize that the antithesis belongs to quite a different category from, say, that of left and right, or day and night. We do not mean only that a working day and a feast day are mutually exclusive. We also mean that work is an everyday occurrence, while a feast is something special, unusual, an interruption in the ordinary passage of time. A holiday every day, or even every other day, is an idea that cannot be realized in practice, even though it may not necessarily run counter to the concept of festivity in itself. It is hardly feasible in the lives of men existing here and now. The festive quality of a holiday depends on its being exceptional. A festival can arise only out of the foundation of a life whose ordinary shape is given by the working day. An idle rich class of do-nothings are hard put to it even to amuse themselves, let alone to celebrate a festival. The dolce vita is a desperately unfestive affair. There is, incidentally, considerable testimony that this sad truth applied also to the courtly festivals of the Baroque period, which many an innocent historian has described as highly festive occasions. The probability is that they sprang not from joy in living, but from fear, from horror vacui, because the true prerequisite for festivity was lacking at these courts. They had no everyday life and no work, nothing but time on their hands, and boredom. Incidentally, pseudo-festivals exist as well as pseudo-work. Not all activity, not every kind of expenditure of effort and earning of money deserves the name of work. That should be applied only to the active and also laborious procurements of the things that are truly useful for living. And it is a good guess that only meaningful work can provide the soil in which festivity flourishes. Perhaps both work and celebration spring from the same root, so that when the one dries up, the other withers. But of course, meaningful work signifies more than the mere fact of workaday accomplishment. The implication is that man understands the work and accepts it for what it really is, namely, the tilling of the field, which always includes both happiness and toil, satisfaction as well as sweat of the brow, joy as well as the consumption of vital energy. If one element in these pairs is suppressed, the reality of work is falsified, and festivity is ruled out. We must consider this matter in more concrete terms. In a totalitarian state, labor is glorified, and government propaganda romanticizes rises in the production indices, as if work were itself a form of celebration. At the same time, true festivity cannot exist in such a state. The very nature of the state is against it. But the possibility of festivity is destroyed even more thoroughly by the other falsification, the view that man's daily life, taken as a whole, is nothing but vexation, meaningless bustle, deadly drudgery, in a word, an absurdity, which, however, the intrepid man, who wishes to surrender neither his dignity nor his clarity of vision, will not simply endure in dull passivity, but will explicitly affirm and choose for the sake of its very absurdity. One must imagine Sisyphus happy, says Albert Camus. Not that this strenuously pursued happiness, this celebration of the victory of the absurd, is very credible. In fact, it is even less credible than the touted, radiant expression of the tractor driver who is meeting his quota. Neither the dedication of the Stakhanovite nor the doggedness of Sisyphus allows room for the spontaneity of life which is indispensable to festal exaltation. For that, it is essential to look upon reality whole, and above all, to taste things as they really are, the bitter bitter and the sweet sweet. To be sure, bitterness itself can contain a healing element. The good may be found in the bad, bonum in malo. This remarkable postulate holds, apparently, only in a single context. I hesitate to call it by name, because to do so will inevitably give rise to a host of misunderstandings, if not worse. I refer to the context of just punishment, and to the fact that the soundest, sanest, and most therapeutic thing a justly punished person can do is to accept his punishment as his due, and not try to falsify it by pretending that he enjoys the taste of it, or that he has chosen it. For by enduring the bitterness, the malum, he may hope that at least by his own life he is atoning for what he has done, repairing the wrong and turning evil to good, that he is restoring a balance that could not be restored in any other way. The fact is, as everyone knows, that Christendom's sacred books call work, and incidentally death also, a punishment. That is a subject too broad to discuss here. Even if we attempted it, we should have to answer the question, why has punishment been imposed, and by whom? And then we should find ourselves squarely in the heart of theology. Still, it is good to remind ourselves that such questions can be meaningfully asked and can also be answered, and it is good for us to be leavened now and again by the idea that a path has already been laid down and leads away from an attitude toward work that is essentially inhuman in both its affirmative and negative aspects. End of the first part of chapter 1.